In his heyday, Dick Cavett seemed to have interviewed almost everyone interesting. The list includes John Lennon, William F. Buckley Jr., Muhammad Ali, Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, and even Lester Maddox. After a long and celebrated career hosting the favorite television show of people who read, Dick Cavett joined the New York Times online opinionated department a few years ago. Some of those columns have been collected in a book called Talk Show, Confrontations, Pointed Commentary, and Off-Screen Secrets. It's just out from Times Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dick Cavett to our show today. Hello.
I am, what is it people always say, thank you for having me.
It sounds
vaguely erotic.
I know. And I always resist making the joke.
I would think anybody with taste would, yes.
The other cliche, but I'm going to ask it anyway, is what happens when the interviewer is on the other side of the mic?
Well, for me, what happens is that I'm always, this is going to sound terrible, I can virtually always promise that I will be good. I learned once when I would, say, appear on Johnny's show and other people's show while I was doing a show, or in Johnny's case, whenever a Cavett show ended, fellow Nebraskan Johnny had me on the next Monday saying things like, I'm afraid that next time it's going to be Armed Forces Radio for Dick. We were very good friends. There's no responsibility being a guest. Somehow, I could never be sure that the show I was going to host that night I would be at my best. But for some reason, the relief of it's not being your show and you can just talk about yourself makes it easy for me to be a guest.
I think there's another factor because I've been on both sides. And that is that I know what makes for an interesting interview, and so I'm going to eliminate all of the stuff that you do not want me to be saying here. I want to keep it as entertaining as possible because
sure.
I know that's what I'd want you to do for me.
Okay. There were two bald guys who – oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm going to do a vulgar joke.
You began your performing career as a gymnast and a magician.
Oh, bless you for mentioning the gymnast thing. I always stand backstage hearing myself introduced and the Emmy winner and all that, and I always want to say, but – state champion gymnast, please, please.
And then, you know, you also, unlike the other people who preceded you in talk shows at the time, people like Dave Garraway, Steve Allen, Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, who had all worked in broadcast jobs before they got their own shows, you had gone to Yale, been an actor, a stand-up comic, a writer. Did the ABC worry when they gave you the show that you weren't fitting the mold?
That I hadn't been a broadcaster?
Right. Well, most people, even today in talk shows, most of them start off as DJs, and then they say, hey, Rush, you have a lot of strong opinions. How would you like to have a talk show?
I came here to learn things, and you've taught me one I did not ever notice before. I guess that's all true. From Garraway on.
Yeah, it's changed since. And then they started having... You know, they started having failed singers and failed comedians and would-be fascist dictators. They give them their own shows. But in the old days, it was people who had just worked their way up from television, Johnny Carson doing a game show.
Yeah, there was sort of a prescribed it's funny. I used to go into Sardi's while I was still an undergraduate to see who would be in there. And often it was Johnny and Ed McMahon at the bar, and we would chat. And I remember thinking, I want to be what Johnny is, but I don't know how he got there, and I don't think I should tell him right now when he's having a drink between five tapings of his game show or something. But and thank you for not asking, is there something in the water in Nebraska?
No, I wouldn't ask that question.
Two talk show hosts have come.
I think I would have asked that question some years back, but I've moved on, Dick.
When you were a green guy.
Were you worried about being a performer yourself? Because you'd always been on the
other
side.
I've always wanted to be a performer myself. And when I began to be one, I was nervous about it, but something told me, this is what I want. And something else told me, I am drawn to the East. The East being not, of course, what we could call the Orient then without being whacked by politically correct people. But New York. Dreaming of New York. Listening to Grand Central Station radio shows opening, ending with Best of the Steaming Men and 4 Mile and Steaming Tenements and then Grand Central. And that happened to me.
A friend who grew up in California told me that her big complaint was that when somebody from Nebraska or Minnesota had to decide whether they wanted to go to the East Coast or the West Coast, the heads all went to New York and the bodies all came to California. I don't know if it's true, but as a Californian.
One body that went to California, I guess you could say, but he went to New York first, was a fellow you've heard of named Marlon Brando. Hmm. Came to New York in his 20s and took the place by storm in 4 or 5 ways all at once. Another guy whose parents owned a brewery more or less went east and then west, and his name was Friedrich Austerlitz, better known to the listener as Fred Astaire. Mm. Isn't that amazing?
Did you interview Astaire?
Yeah, I had two 90-minute shows with him, and he was... he had wanted someone to call him to come on the show. And I couldn't believe it. I don't know how we had skipped ever asking him. And he worked very hard, and he did 2 sensational song medleys. Had to, in fact, get the time expanded between commercials, which was harder than you might think at the network. For him to complete his Cole Porter medley without interruption, for him to complete his, it was planned ahead of time. My band, with great musicians, just stood in awe of Fred Astaire's musicality. And you meet dummies who say, Fred Astaire sings? Yes, ma'am.
Well, the question that people ask me the most and the one that I never know how to answer is, who's your favorite guest? And I'm sure people ask you that all
the time.
I'm
with you,
as well.
Yeah.
I remember the bad ones a lot quicker than I remember the good ones.
Oh, yeah. Some clunkers come to mind more quickly. I've decided it's because the categories are vast. If you say maybe who was your favorite comedian who had a worldwide television program and still does, though dead, I could say, Lucy. But I finally come down to saying it's impossible to answer that, but Groucho meant the most to me.
Groucho because he had been a hero of yours?
A hero, exactly. From earliest memory, it seems, because I'm old enough to remember the game show, as he called it, or the quiz show, You Bet Your Life, when it was radio, and then television. And then I saw the movies. Now my father's generation, of course, saw the movies first.
Well, he was also one of the quickest people in the world, and that is always a problem when you're doing this kind of show. You want to be witty at the same time. He knew how to sacrifice himself. Not every talk show host seems to know how to do that. Carson was just brilliant at being a straight man.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, yeah. It's almost as if he invented that bit of genius.
And so why? Because he was so engaged. Why do you think that he had that reputation for being cold and distant?
Who, Johnny?
Yeah.
Who, Johnny? or as some would say, whom, Johnny? He was socially extremely uncomfortable and maybe cold at times. But I felt sorry for him because I knew I kind of had he loved me. Is that too blunt to say?
No.
And sometimes I thought he envied me the fact that I could run into people from the studio audience in the hall and chat with them, and he simply couldn't.
And yet he was so comfortable chatting with anyone
anybody watching the show would say, what are you talking about? I've seen him chat with people. But something in him rigidly became a tight cord of inhibition when he... talked with folks generally. I survived a roast of Johnny, one of those great Smith and Hemian, the roasts of the, in fact, are coming out on DVDs, those old roasts. It's great. On which I said, people often say that Johnny has a ramrod up his spine. And I glanced over at him and mercifully he laughed.
That's always a problem at roasts. I know I've been roasted, and people thanked me for being willing to take all that stuff. My feeling was that a roast is a great compliment. You expect people to say awful things about you, but it always comes out of love. And I'm sure anything you said about him came out of love.
It's the irony of the roast. Yeah, true.
Yeah. My guest is Dick Cavett, who's written a book. In fact, this is, what, your second, third, fifth?
Cavett, the book, came out in 74. Harkett Brace Yovanovitch, 895. Incidentally, my co-author, Chris Porterfield, and I, when we saw what they were going to charge for the book, and incidentally, there's no ghostwriting in it. It was dialogue for him. Said, who in hell is going to lay out $8 for a book? When I was a kid, books were $2, sometimes $2.50 if you were for the rich. but yeah, that came out then. Then another book came out shortly there, a couple years later, called I, E-Y-E, on Cavett, get the pun. Mm-hmm. And then this one. So this book, which has about 3 years' worth of columns for the Times Online, is out now.
Well, being a blogger, do you get more mail now than you used to as a television host?
Half the fun, really, of doing it, and sometimes the pain, are the wonderful letters. I am stunned by the articulacy and the literacy and the thoughtful minds of the people who write these. Not all, of course, but some are publishable essays. I write a piece about Sarah Palin or about memory or about virginity or obesity or many celebrities, memories from the show. Whatever it is, it seems to inspire, that column seems to inspire beautifully written letter in the hundreds. Now, how many people does that indicate there are in the country who are that smart?
And we'll talk in a little bit about your the importance of language to you.
Okay.
I was wondering whether you miss being in front of an audience, because there is that whole other thing where if you write something funny, you have to wait to see if anybody even responds to it. And they may well, but they're not necessarily going to tell you. But if you say something witty, you get an immediate response.
There's nothing beats the immediate laugh or the immediate groan even or whatever. Yes, you have to wait for the column that says another one of your brilliant things. You're the first person I turn to read, or goodbye forever, Mr. Cavett.
Yeah.
Usually not by the same person.
Well, there's always somebody, no matter what you do, who's going to write something negative to you.
Yeah.
I got
a wonderful piece of hate mail that I showed Alistair Cook. He wanted a copy of it. My secretary wasn't going to show it to me. I'd had Jane Fonda on, probably, and someone comparable. And a telegram form printed somewhat shakily said, "Dear Mr. Cavett, you little sawed-off faggot communist shrimp." And I wrote back, "I am not sawed off." I wonder if they got it.
One of your most famous programs was when Norman Mailer was having words with Jenna Flanner and Gore Vidal. And I want to play a little clip from that.
Okay.
I'll take the two chairs if you will all accept finger bowls.
Yeah, what?
Finger bowls.
What does that mean? What does that mean? I don't understand. I want to know, and then I will respond accordingly. We'll accept finger bowls. To do what in?
Think about it.
Who wants to grab this on our team? No, I nearly have it. It means something to me. Finger bowls. Finger bowls. Things you dip your fingers in after you've gotten them filthy from eating. Am I on the right track? Am I warm?
Why don't you look at your question sheet and ask a question? Hey, could I talk to the audience for a
moment? Why don't you fold it five ways and put it where the moon don't shine?
You did make a habit of insulting your guests, but Norman was being
but I was
rather difficult.
To then.
I've bitten my tongue more than once when a guest has been particularly awful. Jerry Lewis, at one point, I didn't say, "You know, I'm amazed that Dean stayed with you as long as he did, Jerry." because he was being so obnoxious on the show.
Oh, yeah.
But I've always...
That's well calculated.
What, not saying it?
Yeah, I didn't say so. But you could have. You might have. You might have wanted to. I don't know where that remark, which had become somewhat famous and haunted me through the years ever since then, usually misquoted as "stick it where the moon don't shine," or and "stick it," of course, would be vulgar, don't you agree?
Mm-hmm.
And "the sun don't shine." No, moon is poetic. But I don't know where it came from, Nebraska tribal memory. I don't remember ever hearing it before, but some little germ in the brain clicked it out. And, of course, it made Norman, "Kevin, is that something you've had canned for years? I mean, is that something you've been holding, waiting for the opportunity to say it?" Which allowed me to say, "I should have to tell you a quote from Tolstoy." Well, that didn't go over well either.
One of your pet peeves is bad English, people using lay for lie and so forth. Your parents were English teachers. Is that where that sensitivity comes from?
I suppose it did. Yeah, I'm sure it did.
Well, what would have happened if Bob Dylan had come on your show to sing "Lay, Lady, Lay"? Would you have corrected him?
I would. I think I might well have. But he strikes me as the sort of fellow who would be willing to talk about something like that. And I wouldn't want to accuse him of forwarding the cause of bad English. It's funny, I never did a show with Dylan. I wish I had.
You have no love, it seems, for George W. Bush politically or because he mispronounces words like nuclear as nuclear. Do you miss having him as comic relief?
I don't miss anything except about having George Bush. No, it seems to me, and a lot of the readers picked up once on something about him that really irked me. Right after, now this isn't his fault, the timing of it, but right after there had been battle and death on the screen in Iraq, we saw George Bush in that moment where he put his arms out and did a little soft shoe dance for some press people, and I just wrote that it was not pleasant to see this capering loon performing this little number while people were having their buttocks blown away that he sent to other countries.
But you were friends with William F. Buckley, although your politics were quite different.
Yeah, yeah. I liked Buckley, but not the first time he came on my show. For something in me, it was my first week. And he came on, and I was nervous. I was nervous all that first week. I couldn't figure out what to do as people signaled me from all over, and I was trying to concentrate on what the guest was saying. And then I would notice that the guest's lips had stopped moving, and I hadn't heard what the guest had said. And with Buckley, I said, "I'm not familiar with that." And he said, "You don't seem to be familiar with anything." And I thought, what a snotty little thing to say to a guy wearing his first job. And I stammered something out like, "I'm familiar with everything." Hard to believe that from that we became friends. And there are two really, I think, delightful pieces about my delight in knowing Bill Buckley over the years and hanging out with him in some odd places.
Well, was there a problem sometimes when you were having fun, but you remembered that he had written an article that you had totally disagreed with?
There wasn't really, because his personality, when present, was quite, it fulfilled your attention. He was charmingly funny. He performed an elaborate stunt in my presence on Mr. Klerman of Time magazine, on his boat. Shall I tell it quickly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He determined that Mr. Klerman, this is in the Virgin Islands, and I ran into Bill down there, and he said, "Come on the boat," and my wife and my late wife liked him and his wife, and they got along well. And we were all chatting, and he determined that Klerman had never seen The Wizard of Oz. This is in the book. And he said, "It's on the San Juan station tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And tomorrow night came, and I was there, and dinner was eaten. And then Bill said, "Oh, my God, we've eaten into 25 minutes of The Wizard of Oz. And Clemmer was disappointed, and Bill said, let me see how much influence William F. Buckley Jr.'s name has here. Called the station in front of everybody and said, would you mind starting the movie over for me? And everybody laughed, and then the screen went crazy, and it rewound, and the movie started over again. And everyone was stunned. And Bill did reveal that with his other hand out behind a wall, he was manipulating a tape machine. The Wizard of Oz had never been on that night anywhere except in the boat.
When you had people like Eudora Welty as guests for long segments, did the network go crazy?
Yeah. There was nothing they could do about it. If Eudora Welty is there, she's going to get some time if I'm doing the show. Oh, how I loved her.
A very great writer.
I just picked up a book of her... of Eudora Welty on the subject of William Faulkner. I'd forgotten that she had awarded him the big medal and that she was something.
Well, people ask me all the time, how much say do you have in what guests appear on the show? What about you?
Well, I never liked to book the guests. And the reason was that I could always think of some reason why I didn't want them. Now, it wasn't that I didn't like them. Well, in many cases it was, but I mean... It was, but Tony was so great on the last show, I'll have to make it so he's great on this show, too, and maybe I'll fail. And I could always come up with some dumb reason. So I preferred to hand me the show, I'll go out and do it and do my best. And people who knew me were working for me, and so they weren't going to mess up.
It's also, it's a collaborative effort. Doing a show, and they know who yeah. you like and what you're interested in and what you're not interested in. To me, one of the always the most scary moments is when I'm at a party or at some event and somebody comes up to me with a book in his hand. I know that book is going to wind up in my hand, and I would much prefer for them to send it to my producer and go through normal channels. But if anything, that almost prejudices me against that book.
Yes, it can. When there was... Because in effect, they're saying, put me on the show and make me some money.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of want to say, well, could I consider that for a while?
We don't have a lot of time, but you've suffered from clinical depression, was successfully treated with electroconvulsive therapy and antidepressants. What made you decide to go public with that story?
I didn't really ever decide to do it, but somebody said it would be good if you... mentioned it, perhaps. It might help some people. And a lot of people would do anything rather than have that be known about them. And I don't know, maybe in some sense I changed that because people do talk about it more. But I went on Larry King and I wrote about it in People magazine. And the only thing I can say that makes depression worthwhile, since there isn't anything that does, is... You saved my dad's life, or our daughter decided to get treatment because of reading about you. It's that odd notion that if a celebrity does something, it might be okay for me to do it. Since half the things celebrities do, you should shun with your life.
Dick
but,
Cavett.
But that sort of thing was good.
Dick Cavett will be in conversation with Bud Mishkin tonight at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. For more information about that, visit our show page at WNYC.org.
My God, is that tonight?
That's tonight.
Oh, I'm bowling tonight.
Well, I know there's a witty line, but I'm not
kidding, folks.
Dick Cavett, talk show. The book is published by Times Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
I had a lovely time.